WRC board. If you look at the front panel board, all you have there is just a half an inch by 1 inch display. And that one shows you the angle of rotation. So now you can replace your traditional dial that is probably 20 years old. Although this one was good. From some characteristics, the futures, it can be mounted inside rotator controller or use a standalone replacement. Our local remote control can be done by any device with the web browser like PC, tablet, smartphone, etc. OLED, OLED display on the front panel controls are optional, so that one that I told you about. It's powered by 8 to 24 volts AC/DC, and the current is 150 milliamps maximum. Analog input for position reading, 3 times 10 amps SPDX relay, so yeah, I was talking about those relays. Electronics you can buy in ADI or any other store, I mean, not a big deal. So it can be used as an access point and connected to existing Wi-Fi network, web browser, interface for local or remote point, and a short control, point to QRA grid locator, Telnet network interface. Nobody uses Telnet unless you're going to correct me. It's a thing of the past. Let me drop.
Well, there are people who use Telnet. It's a little primitive, but, you know, there are people who don't like to use GUIs, graphic user interfaces. They like to do it all text-based. So I have more than a few Telnet pieces of software to kind of burrow into Raspberry Pis and other devices that tend to prefer more text-based controls.
Okay, thank you for that. UDB Packer listener compatible with N1MM logger and DX lab suit and can be used as elevation rotor. That I don't understand what they're talking about. Can be used as elevation rotor. Well, you have a rotor. But anyhow, looking at the schematic, three very simple relays. Could be separate, could be on the board like it is. And then you have a transformer, so the 8 to 20 volts AC is powering the board with the relays, but of course you have to have a grass bridge or any kind of diode, because those relays accept DC. And then you have a rotor has two wires, you have a capacitor in parallel to the winding, and then you have two wires only from the rotor. So you have one connected to relay number one, second to recollected so that one is CW, and the third one is CCW, and one in the middle is auxiliary, so it's not being used. So it's a piece of cake. So nothing special, but I love the device. Back to you.
Okay, this is AC2GS. I think they were alluding to azimuth rotators as opposed to the type of rotators most of us tend to use on antennas. But they, for some weird reason, I guess they thought people wouldn't know what an azimuth was, so they simply, you know, said height rotator.
Okay. Now, the next one, Chameleon URT1500. So the first one for the people who are interested with it, the guy who sells that is American Foxtrot 6 Sierra Alpha, and the device is called, let me go to that, how is it, Wi-Fi Rotator Controller, WRC, again, Wi-Fi rotator controller, WRC. Okay, now the next subject, Chameleon URT-1500 remote ham radio antenna tuner, $899, 1500 watts, beauty, I love it. Okay, so not much to say about it, apart from that, there is mounted next to the antenna. So in other words, it doesn't have to, and is not made to be mounted next to your rig. It is mounted to your antenna, and that's the big, big advantage for it. Dr. Roy, your comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing new. MFJ has been selling shielded, weatherproofed external antenna tuners for many years. It adds a cost to the design because you got to waterproof it, and usually there's a remote control chassis also that goes at the shack. And, of course, we've talked about this before. The problem with tuning a non-resonant antenna is it only will alter the impedance beyond the point of the antenna tuner. And in the case of a shack-based antenna tuner, that means it'll make it a nice 50 ohms from your antenna tuner to your transmitter, but the rest of the length is going to have the same impedance mismatch that it had before you plugged your antenna tuner in line. So one way of improving the decreasing the attenuation losses of reflecting signals is to put the antenna tuner right at the antenna feed point. So another way of improving the efficiency sometimes is you use open line instead of coax, which has a much lower attenuation loss. So with that, you can get away with putting your antenna tuner back in your shack. But one of the ways to do it is get a antenna-based antenna tuner and a remote button. And like I said, MFJ had them, but unfortunately, you know, they're going to fade away soon. So I guess Chameleon wanted to get into the business too. Chameleon makes very good, sturdy products. They tend to have a slight bias for military near-vertical incident skywaves, and they tend to charge a significant amount of money for their stuff. It's well-made. But the price kind of indicates that. So that's my opinion.
If you're addition center HCN, broadband frequency coverage tunes antennas between 1.8 to 30 megahertz, making it perfect for HF operation, so we don't have 6 meters there. High power capability handles 1500 watts, a single sideband CW, 800 watts on digital mode, and 400 watts for continuous duty modes AM, LTTY, and Whisper. They should add also FM. So if you have 100 watts FM, you likely going to have from the same amplifier about 1.2 kilowatts. In SSB, I'm sorry. Okay. Fast tuning memory recall matches antennas with impedance mismatches up to 16 to 1. Not bad. In just 8 seconds, as little as 0.1 second for stored memory frequencies, which has a 16,000 slots. Well, okay, so they are trying to advertise themselves. And it's good, nothing special. Every good company who makes antenna tuners try to have the same or better. Universal capability operates with a transceiver without need for band specific control cables, thanks to bias key powered coupler unit. What are they talking about? Dr. Roy.
I don't know. I wasn't able to follow what you were saying.
Okay. Universal capability operates with any transceiver without the need for brand-specific control cables, thanks to the bias T-powered coupler unit. So it operates with cables. So what's the difference between brand cables and the cables? Cable is a cable. If you connect it properly, it works. But
there are some tuners that interface, especially when they're from the same manufacturer, that you know you can press tune on the remote button in the chassis, and it will send a signal to your transceiver, turn it on to CW, turn it to 10 watts, and provide a signal that the tuner can now calibrate for effective impedance transformation. Otherwise, you have to do it manually. You have to set your transceiver for CW or FM or AM, something that is continuous, and cut the power down so that you don't burn out your antenna tuner. So it's kind of skirting the whole idea of there's no real wire that goes into your transceiver that sets it up for the 10 watts of CW. You either have to do it yourself or use a button that's already on your transceiver that does the same thing.
Hey, thank you very much for clarifications. I understood that if that was Cat 6 or Cat 7 required, that digital signal would go between the units. If not, the cable is the cable. Multiple antenna options ideal for coaxial feed antennas like inverted V versus dipoles, verticals, and random wire configuration. I'm reading, so, and then it says about the components, tuner kit, coupler kit, flexible antenna connection. So let's see what they say about the coupler kit. Indoor operator interface to seamless integration with your transceiver. Okay. The frequency of a range 1.8 to 30 megahertz. Good stuff. Good stuff. Nothing really inventive. It's just a good workmanship. That's what Dr. Roy says. Okay. Now, the next one would be, let me drop first. Okay. The next one. StatFinder. Yeah. So we're talking about StatFinder from the simplest to radar-based. So we often need to run wires, transmission lines, coaxial cables, and we need the StatFinder for drywall, brick, or concrete. There are a few that I want to mention. There are plenty of them. And one of them is Walbot, W-A-L-A-B-O-T. So Walbot DIY 2, do it yourself 2. Walbot DIY 2. But the good thing is it's advanced StatFinder and a voice scanner for Android, and it costs $165. So you have your Android, and then you have a device that is approximately the size of your Android. You put them together, or you put one next to the other. You just use Wi-Fi to link them together, and you could see on the screen of your Android iPhone, on your Android, the start. The start could be made from plastic, that could be plastic pipe, that could be start, that could be a metal wire, that could be wire on the on the voltage and wire that is that, that could be a copper pipe, whatever you want. Now the second one is Zircon multi-scanner HD900. It does, it costs $62.97. So it's $100 cheaper. And then the next one is D-TECT, Detect, $120. And this one is $211, also nothing special, although it is standalone, doesn't require from you to use your phone. Let me drop for a moment. Okay. Now we have a Bosch as well. But now Bosch Detect 200C. Now this one is $920.66. Of course, the price is before President Trump trying to interfere. I'm sorry. To change something. Okay. But anyhow, it's a nice device with the display on it, and you could see the same which you can see with Wallbot DIY2. Only Bosch is a reputable company, so it's worth your money probably. And then we have Makita. Makita decided, Japanese guys decided they want to somehow create a competition to Bosch. Bosch is German origin and Makita is Japanese. So they made Makita DWD181. It's 18 volts LXT lithium ion cordless multi-surface scanner with charger. And it costs only $1,149.99. This one, guys, this one. You have a brick, you have a concrete, you have a rebar, you have anything you want. And it's going to find it for you. I was recently in one of my houses doing door opening hatch. Like a door service opening in the ceiling, and I had a cheap one and I missed by half of a start, and then I had to patch it. So that took me probably one day longer to do it. Let me draw up. Okay. Now, the signal transmission, the start finder emits radio frequency signal which travels through the wall, signal of reflection, and whatsoever, signal analysis and detection and identification. We try to wrap it up. We have a capacitive-based start finder, edge finders, center finders, instant start finders, and radar-based start finders. So I'm going to just give you words about capacitive one. When the plate inside the start finder is over wallboard, it will sense a one dielectric constant value, but when it is over a start, the dielectric constant is different. It works on capacitance, differential bridge mode, so generating by sensing density difference, is able to flip the bridge, like a Wheatstone bridge, something like a traditional Wheatstone bridge. It's just a bridge. Okay, so you have a level difference. You're operating op-amp logic at TTL level, which is plus minus 5 volts. Triggered, but in 2025, actually it's not 2025. It was a long time ago. Let me jump, hold on. Okay. There was the simple logic based on open collector. So instead of using op-amp, we could use the open collector. Many of the companies use that kind of technique. It is acting like a switch connected to the relay, and the relay is able to drive the small piezoelectric sounder at some sort and some sort of display. So the only difference is that open collector cannot handle current, big current, so it actually acts like a switch, on-off switch, a piece of cake. Now, the edge finders are good, are really good from the old, but they have to be calibrated on empty section of the wall, and then it can be moved along the wall until it senses charge, the change of density. So it's just changing the capacitors. The capacitor is the same. The only difference is that it doesn't have to be calibrated. Then center finders find you center of the stud, and instant stud finders just the first that they have more sensors. So they could be more accurate, but the radar based one is actually it related to the echo, the longitudinal wave echo is something you experience at all time. If you shout into a well or canyon, the echo comes back a moment later. So it's nothing special on it, but those are really good ones. And they could go specially Makita. They say they go Cinderblock, that's a German wall, Cinderblock. I don't know how wide it is, but it's probably 24 inches. No, less than that. So if you have a wall made from the brick and the Cinderblock is inside, then you can quickly find out what is behind, so you do not drill into the pipe or the rebar. Jeff?
KD2FIU.
Go ahead.
You have to let more time to stop in case anybody needs to come in for any emergency traffic.
Dr. Roy, I didn't catch that.
He said that you have to put more of a pause during your presentation in case there is someone who needs to use the repeater for emergencies.
I do thank you very much for that comment, and I definitely agree with you. I should do that.
Thank you, Roy. KD2FIU.
You're welcome, George.
Okay. Thank you very much, George. Okay. The next one. So we have boats can see Earth's magnetic field navigation that could be used in drones with use of AI. So the approaches, Iron, there were approaches, but Dr. Ray would actually correct if that was true. So one of the approaches, that was many years ago, like 15 years ago. They were they thought that iron in the beaks of the birds provide a magnetic compass. But then they find out that the protein in their eyes let them see the Earth's magnetic field. Two recent studies from researchers at Lund University in Sweden and the Karl von Ossetzky University of Oldenburg in Germany discovered that the ability is a result of special protein in bird's eyes. If you could comment on it, back to you, Dr. Ray.
KC2GS, okay. I mean, if anyone is keeping a scorebook, the particular protein in the bird's retinas is called cryptochrome 4. So it's sensitive to magnetic fields, and it can detect it, and it uses that ability for its migrations.
Okay. If you could say a few words about animal magnetoreception that relates to turtles, newts, spotted newts, lobsters, honeybees, plenty of others. I'm trying to recall whatever is in my head.
I don't have anything special. Evolution works in interesting ways, and different species can evolve different sensory abilities. Sometimes it just branches out and it's reusing the same old designs that are left behind, but sometimes it reinvents the wheel every so often. So, different species have evolved different means sometimes, or re-evolved those means to perceive what's invisible to us, but effectively improves their survivability and, evolution in action. Those animals that evolved to be able to sense these things, if it improves their chances of surviving and reproducing their genes to the next generation, they manifest that across their entire species. So it's a fascinating thing, biology and evolution. They're still complaining that it doesn't exist on the Internet, of course, because that's what the people do on the Internet.
Okay, interesting. If you could say a few words about radical pair-based avian compass. There are two models of it, magnetoreception and magnetite-based model. If you remember about that stuff, back to you.
Well, again, it's two different methods to do the same thing. The one with seemingly a little bit more finesse to me is the protein in which you evolve the production of a protein which interacts with magnetic fields and allows things like birds to see them. There are other ways you can evolve small iron oxide magnetite deposits in your body with sensory organs to tell if it's being moved around, which only happens in a relatively strong magnetic field. So those are two major different type of ways to do magnetic sensing in a organic biological organism.
Okay, so I understand from that what you said, that the, and correct me if I'm wrong, radical pair reaction in retina of the bird could in some way affect the sensitivity of light receptors in the eye. So the modulation, or I'm trying to find the proper word, the reaction products by a magnetic field would lead to modulation reaction of retina. I mean, don't take the word modulation literally.
Well, yeah, it modifies the bird's ability to perceive light in their retinas, and they've evolved to be able to use that information to guide them geographically.
Okay. So the next one is what happened to Felix Baumgartner capsule. Felix Baumgartner capsule. And that subject was for both of you. It was Paul and Freud. I'm not sure if Paul had the time to read that email that I sent to him and comment on it. So if you don't mind, Paul, do you have a comment?
I read a bunch of them that you sent, but which one was this? This had to do with the capsule? Which astronaut or which cosmonaut?
Okay. There was a guy. We call him astronaut, cosmonaut. I'm not sure. Does he deserve that? Felix Baumgartner, he jumped from the capsule. So the capsule was, maybe you start from the beginning. That was in, he was born in 1969. He's Austrian, a sky driver, daredevil, and a base jumper. But one day he spoke to Red Bull Company, and they decided that why not? We'll put a bunch of money, and guy, you want to jump? Jump. So jump. Okay, so he is widely known for jumping to air from helium balloon from the stratosphere on October 14, 2012, landing in New Mexico, United States, and that was a Red Bull Stratos project. So by that, there was a guy in last century who did something like that, but he was never close to 24 miles jump. So the video was showing all of the details, but if we didn't have a time, maybe Dr. Wade could comment on it. Hold on. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I did read that. I thought you were talking about something else. I did read that one.
Okay. Dr. Roy, did you see the video?
Yeah, I saw it. It didn't really interest me. He's this guy who likes to do spectacles. So I'm not really interested in spectacles. I'm interested in science.
Hey, Roy, that topic we talked extensively on this net, believe it or not. What say 2012? I remember talking about that extensively on this net.
Yeah, I remember listening to it. It just, doesn't particularly float my boat. It's, it's a guy who, look at me, daddy, type of thing. I perceive it to be. So it doesn't interest me as much as, when someone's trying to figure out, where all the neutrinos went. And then other, more subtle aspects of science.
And the guy that was playing the role of Capcom, he was talking to Felix as he was coming down. That guy, he did it himself, maybe right before NASA was even called NASA. Really early on. But that guy he was talking to was the same guy. He did it, 30, 40 years earlier, whatever it is. Okay. On a comment about the birds, by the way, I just read recently. There's people that take these pigeons they were talking about was an island, and then they take these pigeons to either France or Germany, and on a train or something, and let them go, and sure enough, eventually go all the way back to their nest. It is amazing. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, evolution is fascinating. What you can come up with a couple of billion years of time to play around with base pairs. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, enter HGN. The next one is drones. But it's not about regular drones. So hydrogen drones. There is a company in Korea called Helium. Helium Industries Incorporated. H-Y-L-I-U-M Industries Incorporated. They're in Korea. So the thing is that regular drone that we can buy from DJI are actually from B&H. Okay. 45 minutes, if you get 45 minutes of flight time from it, is good. But this one can stay afloat 7 hours of flight time. It needs only 5 minutes for fast refueling, 15 kilometers, that would be 10 miles, video transmission, and it has a few cameras on it and whatsoever. It's not big, it's probably a little bigger than Mavic, but the bottle is much bigger than that. So that is interesting. But then there is a competition, is H2 Drone Marine Solution, that's for marine. And this is, it wouldn't be anything special if not that it is done by Dosan, D-O-S-A-N, Mobility, Dosan Mobility. The Dosan is a very, very, very respected CNC machining manufacturer from Korea. One of the top of the lines of CNC mills and other specialized CNCs on it. So that's important. And then we're talking about hydrogen powered aircraft. I wonder what Dr. Roy thinks about it, and eventually if there is any comments. Dr. Roy, please.
Okay, I mean, it's a nice technology. The problem is the infrastructure. With a DJI drone, you plug it into some power source and you're away. Where do you get fuel cells for these things? How expensive is the whole thing? What's the maintenance of the whole thing? So, you know, again, you end up having to pay someplace for the fact that it runs for 7 hours. So I'd be more interested in its expected cost per unit and if there's any kind of a reasonable infrastructure where it wouldn't be semi-impossible to get fuel cells for it.
Okay, so if that was so much of a problem, then we have something that I didn't mention yet. We have ISS, Aerospace. This is a military contractor that made automated autonomous drone design and manufacturing and operation for wide area of UAS intelligence. Then the second one, military contractor, Gatfin. They made a fixed-wing hybrid drone for long-range medical package. Of course, we're talking about hydrogen. Then there is H3 Dynamics. It's a hydrogen-powered drones only, I believe. Another military contractor, fuel cell propulsion systems, drone in the box station. Usually what is made for military at some point comes to the civilian words or words of the civilian mostly commercial application back to you, Dr. Ray.
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. You used to like to use the microwave as the universal explanation for all that, and it works for microwaves, but it doesn't work for everything. Again, you're dealing with we've discussed hydrogen, liquid, gas, what have you, many times here before, and it has a lot of different requirements that don't necessarily scale up well. So this is not just, you know, it's cheaper to make 1,000 of them than it is to make 1,000 times. It might be different for hydrogen technology because we don't really have a hydrogen infrastructure already built into our society. We would have to manifest one. So the scalability is a question. The price, sometimes, yeah, if you make them in enough numbers, you can bring the price down. But there are some technologies that, again, they don't scale particularly well. There's no incredible savings by building 1,000 of them. So it depends on the technology. You can't kind of make assumptions about every invention having the same scalability curve.
Okay. Paul, do you have a comment?
I don't. No. I just had one technical question I was going to ask Roy, but then I forgot about it. Maybe I could do that. Back to you, Wes.
Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Kind of think of the instrument that you would use to try to find a broken wire on you know, in my neighborhood, there's, you know, we have street lights, and up the block there's one light that's out, and the town is having a hell of a time trying to find where the break is, and they go through this process of putting fuses in, waiting for the thing to blow, and I don't know, you know, it's, you know, for some reason they're having a problem. But isn't there an instrument, let's say you have, you know, it's 120 volt line running down the street, you know, and you suspected that there was a break, you know, and it might be 20 feet away, it might be, you know, 150 feet away. Isn't there some kind of a gadget that you could hook up, you know, that would send the frequency down, and you would be able to tell, you know, how many feet down this, how many feet in length where the break would be. Back to you, Ron.
Okay. I mean, in principle, yes, it's probably possible to do that. I mean, time domain reflectometers do that for transmission lines all the time. You would probably have need to design something a little bit more broad-based. Because regular electrical carrying lines don't really have the same qualities as transmission lines do. But it's probably possible. So you could either send a signal down a particular wire and look for a reflection at the discontinuity, or you could inject some kind of RF energy and then run some sensors along parallel to the wires and see if there's any significant, you know, decrease in the signal strength, suggesting a discontinuity. So there's probably things. I just don't know if they're commercially available.
Okay.
Okay, you're saying it's time to make a reflectometer. Would probably do it. You would think that would be a common thing that, you know, that the town would have something like that, but I don't know. If we're going off, it would, no, not days, but weeks, you know. very strange. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Thanks for the information. Just curious about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. I would assume if anyone had access to a device like that, it would be the utility companies because they run a certain percentage of underground wires, and an ability to detect discontinuities would be very useful for those. I don't think you'd need it that much on the overhead wires because I think a visual inspection can pretty much give you a good idea of what's going on out there.
Okay,
yeah, this is different than the city. You know, the city, you know, you have Con Ed, like, doing everything. But if you have, let's say you have a development, and you have, you know, streetlights, could be in a condo, and, you know, it could be private houses. You know, the streetlights themselves out here are done by the town. You know, they don't send PSE&G, you know, the equivalent of Con Ed, have to do that kind of work, which is very strange, but that's the way they do it. And PSE&G, you know, they'd probably find it in about 2 seconds. But the towns, you know, there's countless amount of towns, and they have their own department. Who knows, you know, what's going on with those people. Anyway, thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. That's the efficiency aspect of monopolies. They're inefficient in some ways, but they're efficient in others.
Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. We'll see. I would imagine something like that would be, well, I'll look it up on the internet, but probably a very costly thing. By a time domain reflectometer.
Wow, well, I'm sure the Chinese can sell it for cheap.
Okay, that's because I went out there with, you know these little detectors that if you go near an AC voltage, you know, and they go beep, 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 you know. I think I got mine from Craftsman decades ago. And I thought, well, maybe I could pick up a signal, you know. But I... because it does work 2 or 3 inches away from a source. So I thought I could put it near the fiberglass poles that they have, you know, and see if there's anything in there, anything live. But I got no joy on that.
I have an answer for it because I was using such a device to trace the wire. You have a tone generator, and then you have a zond. And the zond is able to sense the signal from the wire. Now, there are a number of devices, time domain reflectometer is not going to work on it. You have a voltage from one side and you have a broken wire from the other side. And we do not know if the voltage is still present on the hot wire or it's on the ground wire. There are generators that you can buy in electrical supply. Very not costly ones.
Sounds like something dropped out. That'll be $60.
$80. I don't know how much is now.
Okay, something weird is going on, I think, with the receiver. I don't think people are hearing each other, because everyone's doubling with everyone.
My echoing disconnected. Hold on. Let's take the headset. It says cannot connect. It says cannot connect. Hold on.
Okay, we seem to have some disconnects from the repeater. I don't think people can hear each other from different repeaters and from EchoLink. I heard Frank got dropped off of the EchoLink. I see Wesley's still on the EchoLink, so I'm not quite sure what's going on. Yeah, he just fell off. So there's a little bit of a weirdness going on with EchoLink. Thankfully, it didn't seem to affect all start. So I'm not quite sure if the both repeaters are listening to each other, because that might be the reason why Wesley started to talk before Paul finished talking. So hopefully, if you give the computers a little bit of time, people get logged back on. Frank is logged back on, and Wesley is logged back on. So hopefully, we could do this without banging into each other.
Okay, I'm on the calling pad. Okay, so let's refresh it. Okay, so another topic that I have is New Atlas versus its Chinese clone. That was for Roy and Paul. At least I thought that would be kind of interesting to them. Well, let me say a few words first, but let me jump. Okay. So, a young boy who escaped from the terror of Eastern Europe never thought that the country of his dream will be driven into the wildness, uncertainty, narcissism, nepotism, collapsing economy, and risk of recession in just a period of 100 days. Since NAFTA 1994, American technology fled to China, where it was allowed to be stolen or voluntarily given to feudal dictators in exchange for enslaving cheap labor, supporting communist China that is now threatening us, our well-being, and as well as Russia's dictator at his war in Ukraine. This is not a political, it's a history, and it's a fact. And now we have Atlas II. Atlas II is humanoid. In 2025, Boston Dynamics, mostly fueled by federal taxpayer money, although it is Honda business right now, made incredible progress creating bipedal humanoids, having the ability to move naturally while being far more advanced in it than the human animals. In other words, it does everything the same way in terms of its bipedalism. It moves the body forward when it's running. So I mean, it is so natural, and it is in the video that I sent to Dr. Roy and Paul. So we have something really that differs from 2012, where they had a bulky staff that was able to operate only a few minutes. And what happened 2 months later, Chinese presented their own very similar humanoid that looks and performs almost the same way. So now we have a Chinese able to make a copy, at least what I understand, make a copy of that what is Boston Dynamics in 2 months. And they were working for 15 years to go to this point. Okay, before I go further, let me refresh it. Okay. That video that I sent to Dr. Wei is 17 minutes, so it's quite long, but it explores Boston Dynamics' latest Atlas robot, its humanoid, agility, NVIDIA-powered intelligence, real-time adaptation, and role in search and rescue. It compares Atlas to robots like Tesla Optimus and Optronics Apollo, raising ethical questions about AI-human coexistence, workplace automation, and the future of humanoid integration in daily life. If you want to buy the Chinese version is made by a company in China called Uni3, and it's called Uni3 G1, and it costs $21,600. And you have it, guys. But I'm not sure if you try to buy Boston Dynamics how much you're going to be paying for it. Dr. Roy, do you have a comment?
I don't know. I don't know what to make of any of this. None of these things are robots the way I grew up thinking of robots. You know, you think of Arnold and Terminator. These are not Arnold and Terminator. These are puppets. There's very little artificial intelligence. None of it is generative artificial intelligence. I think they had a contest where humanoid robots ran a track, and I think by the end all of them fell over before they reached the finish line. They don't really walk like human beings. I mean, they're very flexible, and they can do a lot of things that I could never do even when I was young, because every joint is double-jointed. But it's not human. If you just run a silhouette of these robots moving around, a five-year-old can tell the difference between a human being and these puppets. And again, they're all puppets. The Musk puppet is a particularly unctuous puppet, and don't even believe any of the things that they say about that robot. The Unitree is a small model. It's about 4 feet and a couple inches. It weighs something like 70 pounds. I don't think it has any real internal intelligence, and it's kind of cheaply made. So, you know, for short little videos, they look fine. They look wonderful. I think if you kind of lived with one for a day, you'd be incredibly disappointed.
Okay, thank you very much for that comment. You're probably right, but then try to present something for sale or to attract somehow somebody or some entities, and they show absolutely incredible. The thing is that there is a big difference between Tesla, Elon Musk robot and Boston Dynamics robot and the Chinese one. Although the Unitree G1 is really, really, really something. You gotta see that. I sent also another video, but I'm gonna just read what is inside on it. So the video covers an overview of top humanoid robot showcase at CES 2025. So that would be Realbotics, and they have Melody and Arya, and those are emotional robots, emotional, so they could make a face, facial emotion. Another one is Advanced Mobility Industrial Application, Boston Dynamics New Atlas. Then another one is mentioned by me, Unitree G1. And this one is for two versions. One is for industrial automation, and the other one is for education. The lifelike expression and magical futures by Ameca from Engineered Arts, and then Tesla Optimus Gen 2. I don't want to use the words because somebody could feel offended just because of me using the words. But I'm not satisfied with the quality. Nobody cares about it. But okay. Then there is another one, Figure 2, impact of labor shortages in manufacturing, logistics. I don't know what they're talking about. Okay. There is another one, Pudu D9. Pudu D9 is mostly made for commercial use, so it's like you put it online. It could walk, probably cannot talk. But yes, puppets, you got it right, Dr. Roy. Back to you.
Yeah, I would love to see an actual robot. You know, I read everything Isaac Asimov ever wrote, and you know, he wrote the three laws of robotics and all that stuff. By the way, one of the people that you mentioned was at CES at the beginning of this year, and they had the